This meeting will come to order, please. I know we have some latecomers this morning because of the weather, but we'll begin. After today, you may sit wherever you like. It's become more difficult to place nameplates where we started than it is to just let you sit where you want, so I think we'll be doing just fine, and Melissa's getting to know you, so that will work very well. I hope you've taken a look at our very short minutes, because these are probably the shortest you'll ever see. And please note that Representative Kiefer's name is misspelled, and we will make sure that it's IE. I should have caught that when my CLA had me look at these, and I apologize, Representative Kiefer, because I do know how to spell your name. So with that, may I have a motion to approve the minutes from January 6th? Representative Kath moves that we accept the minutes as corrected from January 6th. Is there any discussion? Any further corrections? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, same sign. The minutes are approved from January 6th, and the correction of Representative Kiefer's name will be made for the record. Today we are going to take a look at licensure as we prepare for Thursday, at which time I'm hoping we'll lead off with Representative Mariani's bill. He was ill yesterday, so I've not gotten approval. So if you saw the schedule and you noticed Representative Garofalo's bill was listed first, Representative Mariani's bill is House File Number 3, and that should be first. I left a note for him yesterday, so I'm hoping that he's agreed to that. They're a little different, and we want to hear both of them. And I look forward to that being part of the agenda on Thursday, in addition to a partial presentation by the Chamber of Commerce on what we need in our workforce for the future. So with that said, today we have Karen Ballmer, who is the Executive Director of the Board of Teaching, who is stuck in traffic, and we have John Milik, who is the Director of Licensing at the Department of Education under the Board of Teaching. And as soon as we have our technical things ready, we'll begin. Thank you, Mr. Vetter, for coming to help us. I believe in your folders you now have a save folder. And maybe it's not in your folder, so perhaps you want to add that to your folder. And in that place, the handouts that you get that you want to save. And then you had an items for today, which I believe the pages would like you to keep also in the folder so that they can add to that and we don't waste folders. We want to be good stewards of our natural resources and make sure that we're not using more paper than we should and more folders than we need to. Mr. Vetter, are you close, do you know? Because if you are, I would start with Lisa Larson's summary that she's put in the packets.
That's pretty close.
Ms. Larson, would you begin? And everyone, she's going to be addressing the House research summary that she's provided based on the state law on teacher quality and effectiveness. Ms. Larson.
Madam Chair, members, what you have in front of you is one of the House research short subjects. We have short subjects on myriad numbers of topics, hopefully of relevance to the legislature. What you've got here is a summary of those areas of state law and rule that address the issues of teacher quality and effectiveness. And the point of looking at this is in part to say this is the landscape as you find it. if the bill introductions are any indication of one of the issues that may be before the legislature and this committee in particular this year, it may be that of teacher quality and effectiveness. And when you consider legislation, when you hear proposals, when you hear testimony from witnesses, what you need to understand is that none of us confronts these issues in the abstract, in a vacuum, with a blank slate, and that all of it has to be considered in context. And the context that you've got here before you are those areas where previous legislatures have effected laws pertaining to teacher quality, and I've listed five of them for you. They have to do with teacher education, teacher preparation, teacher licensure, teacher compensation, and also teacher certification. And I'm going to go through these very quickly because you're going to hear from experts in licensing and teacher preparation generally in a few minutes. And this is only meant to be an overview, nothing more. However, you should be aware that we do have entities that are responsible for aspects of teaching in Minnesota, and also we have statutory programs that are further designed to support the quality and effectiveness of teachers. First, Karen Ballmer, who is stuck in traffic but I know will be here today, is the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Teaching. That board is charged by the legislature with approving teacher preparation programs as well as institutions. The board has the ability to approve institutions, conditionally approve them, suspend and revoke their approval, and also to approve experimental programs of one sort or another. The whole purpose of this is to evaluate programs and institutions to ensure that teacher candidates are provided with the knowledge and skills they need and therefore are able to demonstrate mastery of the subject matter and pedagogy before teaching. The standards that the Board of Teaching uses to evaluate preparation institutions and programs are similar to national standards. There isn't a national association for colleges and teacher education called NCATE, and those standards are used to accredit teacher preparation institutions and programs. In order to be licensed, teachers must satisfy both the preparation requirements and then later, once they receive their license, must satisfy continuing education requirements. A candidate who completes a teacher preparation program in another state has to negotiate essentially with the board to come to some agreement about what additional preparation would be required to receive a Minnesota license. The board also has the ability to issue licenses for specific circumstances, including a non-renewable license, a temporary limited license, and a short call substitute teacher license. In preparing to be a teacher, a candidate has to pass a basic skills exam. The candidate has to successfully complete a teacher preparation program with student teaching and has to learn the pedagogy and skills that they demonstrate later by passing the requisite exams. Once a teacher has a license, there are continuing education requirements. Teachers have to complete 125 clock hours of continuing education in order to renew a five-year professional license. In statute, we've specified a number of content areas for continuing education, including learning about the warning signs of mental illness in children and adolescents, reading preparation, positive behavior interventions, use of technology, and professional reflection and growth. All of these areas are designed to ensure that there is a requisite level of teacher quality and effectiveness throughout the time that a teacher holds a license. Also in Chapter 122A, where you find the Board of Teaching and the Board of School Administrators, there are other statutory requirements pertaining to teachers of deaf and hard of hearing students, teachers of blind and visually impaired students, American Sign Language interpreters, assessment professionals, and even head varsity coaches. So there is a lot of legislation in Chapter 122A having to do with people who are involved in the profession of teaching directly or as support for classroom teachers. Then the next area where the legislature has been involved has to do with the terms and conditions of new and continuing contract teachers. There are two statutes in 122A that govern teachers. 122A40 applies to teachers generally. 122A41 applies to teachers in first-class city school districts. A new teacher is a probationary teacher for 3 years. The law requires that they be evaluated. However, under the law, the standards for the evaluation are not specified, and school boards do have considerable discretion in deciding whether to renew or not renew the contract of a probationary teacher. In plain terms, probationary teachers are essentially at-will employees. Once a teacher satisfactorily completes that 3-year probationary period, they become a continuing contract or tenured teacher, depending upon which section of law we're talking about. The two terms are used interchangeably. The kinds of protections that arise go to due process requirements, so that a teacher is let go for statutorily established grounds and according to a process. Finally, in terms of the law, there is one additional area where the legislature has developed further law. In 1999, the Millikan Foundation started something called the TAP, the Teacher Advancement Program, and it had several components that later were integrated into the QCOMP system. They had to do with professional development, evaluations, performance bonuses based upon evaluations, as well as student test scores and a career ladder. The TAP program had, I think, approximately five participants in 2001. In 2004, Waseca and Minneapolis got a federal grant to further develop TAP. Today, the Minneapolis program has expanded that TAP program, and Waseca is no longer doing it. However, in 2005, the Minnesota legislature adopted QCOMP. It incorporated a number of those TAP elements. It is a professional development and compensation plan. All QCOMP plans have 5 components. One, a career advancement option. 2, professional development. 3, a teacher evaluation plan. 4, performance pay. And 5, an alternative salary schedule. Receipt of QCOMP funds is contingent on 2 things, approval from the Department of Education and the availability of QCOMP funds. In the last school year, 2009 and 10, the department had approved 44 districts and 31 charter schools to implement QCOMP. This most recent school year, 2010-2011, the department has approved in total 50 school districts and 54 charter schools to implement the program. Finally, although this is not in law, it is referred to in rule, and that is National Board Certification. There are national professional teaching standards and corresponding assessments. There is a certification process. It's all voluntary. A number of Minnesota teachers have gotten this certification. What research exists suggests that certification does, in fact, improve teacher practice and morale, professional development, improves school leadership, mentoring, monitoring of student performance, team building, curriculum development. However, the research is much more mixed in terms of whether certification positively impacts student achievement as measured by standardized achievement tests. National Board Certification is referred to in licensure rules having to do with issuing licenses as well as fulfilling clock hour requirements. So now what you've got here are those areas where the legislature has weighed in terms of teacher evaluation. So when you hear bills, when you hear alternative certification bills or other bills related to teacher evaluation and accountability, bear in mind that you do not have a clean slate, that what you are working with, what you either have to enhance, change, repeal, or in some way alter are the laws that currently exist pertaining to quality and effectiveness.
Thank you, Ms. Larson, very much. And I think with that, we'll turn to one of our testifiers today, one of our presenters maybe is better said. John Mielek is the educator licensing head at the department. And welcome very much, John, to our committee. And please say your name for the record, identify what you're here to do and what your position is at the department, and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is John Mielek. I'm the Director of Educator Licensing with the Minnesota Department of Education. And today I'm going to give you a brief overview of what some of the background of licensing is. How do we issue licenses? How many licenses do we issue? And a number of tidbits.
Excuse me, Mr. Mielek, but we're checking to see if members have the handout. Thank you.
So I will give you a brief licensure overview. One of the things that I will talk about is what do we do when we can't find a fully licensed teacher for our classroom? We have a number of options. One, to give you just a real brief overview of highly qualified. Again, give you some of the numbers of licenses we print, and then share with you the 2010 shortage areas so you have an understanding of where we have a need for teachers, and then, of course, other issues as they may arise. Currently, there's two ways, really, that people come into the licensing system. One is they complete a licensure program in the state of Minnesota that's been approved by the Board of Teaching, or they complete an out-of-state program and want to move into Minnesota. The first is a little easier than the second. If I complete a Minnesota-approved program, the first thing I obviously have to do is get into that program, complete the preparation program at the college, pass the Minnesota teacher licensure examinations, which do include a basic skills test, which covers basic reading, writing, and math skills, and then both a subject and pedagogy-specific test. At that point, the college will then recommend me to the state for licensure. I need to complete a background check with both the BCA and the FBI. As soon as all those things are complete, my office will issue a 5-year standard license to that teacher. If someone's coming from a state other than Minnesota or another country, it gets a little bit more difficult. The first thing they have to do is they have to complete all the same test requirements that a Minnesota graduate does. Their college from their home state has to recommend them to Minnesota for licensure. At that point, a licensing specialist in my office will review their transcripts to determine if they've completed an essentially equivalent program. And what we're looking for, does it match Minnesota's scope and content? So, for example, a number of states issue a K-3 license. That, in Minnesota, doesn't exist. We have K-6. And so that's not a one-to-one match. These people will also have to do a background check with both the BCA and the FBI. What happens with all that? Well, if everything lines up perfectly, they've completed all the tests, their scope and sequence matches, and we've determined it to be essentially equivalent to a Minnesota program, they could be issued a 5-year standing teacher license, just like anyone who completed a Minnesota program. More often than not, what happens is they're not essentially equivalent. And so they'll either be issued a temporary 1-year license, so maybe they are missing a student teaching experience or something that can be done in a year. They may also be issued a 3-year restricted license, and this would tend to happen when someone doesn't have the same scope. So that K-3 teacher is going to have to add 4th and 5th and 6th grade and may need a couple of years to do that, so we can give them a 3-year restricted license. Or, worst case scenario, we may actually deny them a license. The renewal condition on their license will indicate the requirements for renewal, and the applicant also receives a letter from the licensing executive explains the rationale for the decision. We want people to know why they didn't get the license. Again, typically, we're going to restrict to scope, content, or possibly both. And that does happen. We see a lot of 712 English licenses. In Minnesota, that's a 512 communication arts and literature. So in that instance, they're missing both the content and the scope, and they're going to need some time to work on that. When Minnesota districts are hiring and can't find a fully licensed teacher, we have a number of permissions that are issued on allowing a person to come in and teach a subject for which they're not licensed. The first one is a personnel variance. This is covered in Minnesota rule, and it's a permission granted for a fully licensed teacher to serve in a position for which they're not licensed. A teacher can use three variances over the course of their career. The variances actually goes to the district to hire that person for an area they're not licensed. The goal is to have that person licensed in that additional subject at the end of the 3 years. The second is a waiver. This is covered in statute. This is a special permission for one or more licensed individuals to teach out of their subject area in an experimental or innovative program for which perhaps there's not an appropriate license. Waivers are usually used in alternative settings, not limited to, but a care and treatment center, alternative learning center, charter school. It's really a situation where you have a unique learning opportunity for students. So, for example, you have maybe a math teacher who's teaching in a seat-based program, so they're going to be teaching that student chemistry, physics, life science, English, social studies. What the board can do in that instance is waive all those requirements so that one teacher can teach all of those subjects. We have a temporary limited license, which is a special permission granted to an individual who possesses at least a bachelor's degree with a major or minor in the field, but has not received teacher preparation. This is good for 1 year and can be renewed three times. There's a non-licensed community expert. This is, again, covered in statute. It's a special permission granted by the full board of teaching for a district to hire an individual not licensed but has a specific area of expertise related to the teaching assignment. And finally, a non-renewable license. This is covered in rule. We still consider a fairly new permission, as it was issued for the first time in the 2006-2007 school year. The non-renewable license allows a professionally licensed individual to teach out of field in a subject as she or he works towards full licensure. The district only needs to apply for this once and doesn't have to advertise each year. The difference with the non-renewable is very similar to a variance. We're giving a licensed teacher permission to teach in a field they're not licensed, so for example, math teaching reading. We're going to give that person 3 years up front. The variance expires every year, and they need to reapply. In order to get the non-renewable, I have to be enrolled in a teacher preparation program that leads to the appropriate license. So the thought is, if someone's made that commitment, we'll make a commitment to the district to give them 3 years to finish their program up front. Each of these permissions has to be applied for by the district, and the district has to show they've advertised, they've tried to find a licensed teacher to fill that position, and for whatever reason were unable to. We're going to move into highly qualified. Highly qualified is something you're going to hear a lot about. It is separate from a licensure perspective, and I'll explain that in just a second. We have 9 areas that are covered under highly qualified. It's only the core content areas as identified by the federal government. English, language arts or reading, mathematics, the sciences, civics and government, history, geography, economics, all world languages, and the arts. In Minnesota, we define the arts for highly qualified as only visual and music. Highly qualified is part of the No Child Left Behind Act. Majority of our teachers had to be highly qualified by June 30th, 2006. The expectation is that they will be highly qualified when they're hired by a district. Licensure and highly qualified, although spoken hand-in-hand most time, are actually separate requirements. Licensure does not always equal highly qualified. Our state law requires that all Minnesota teachers be licensed or hold one of the permissions we talked about a minute ago through the Board of Teaching to teach in a public or charter school. NCLB, the Highly Qualified Teacher Verification, addresses content, knowledge, and core academic subjects. So a teacher has to demonstrate that they have have content mastery of the subject they're teaching. When all of this first came out in the early 2000s, we scrambled to make existing teachers highly qualified. And one of the things that we used was the house process. The house process was a point system designed to recognize people's background in education, their teaching experience, student achievement, professional licensure they've gained, such as the National Board, or any number of professional development activities they may have completed. The goal was to get 100 points. If you had your 100 points, you were highly qualified in your subject. Since 2006, that June 30th, 2006, we no longer use house. The only way to become highly qualified in Minnesota is for new teachers is by passing the state licensure content test, which is one of our licensing requirements. They can also hold an academic major or the equivalent or a graduate degree in the core academic area that they teach. Minnesota's ahead of the game on the rest of the country in that our licensure system was already designed to measure that content knowledge, so this has been a pretty smooth transition for us. Then I want to give you some of the numbers. When we're thinking about licensing and teachers, what happens out in the school districts? Currently, we employ over 56,000 licensed teachers. That's in our public schools today. In the 2009-2010 school year, we had 96.71% of all of our classes in all of our public schools taught by fully certified teachers, hold the full five-year license in their content area. So of the 3.3%, what was happening that they weren't fully licensed? 0.66% were on one of the limited licenses, 1.21% were on a variance, 0.74% were on a waiver, 0.23% were on a community expert, 0.19% were on a non-renewable license, 0.02% were actually teaching with an expired license. They held the appropriate license but were expired. 0.22% had no license or permission from the board, which all said and done, minus the 0.02% and the 0.22%, 99.7% compliance with state law. They either had the appropriate license or the appropriate permission from the Board of Teaching to be in the classroom without that license. In 2008, the agency implemented an online renewal, clock hour, and first-time licensing system. We call that the Center for Educator Licensing, CEL. CEL does not handle endorsements or expansion of licenses. So in 2010, CEL processed 19,148 renewals, fully licensed teachers renewing their license. Also handled 6,870 first-time applications. These are people who are brand new to the profession, coming in for the first time. In addition, the system had 127,271 clock hour additions into the system. Those are the 125 clock hours Ms. Larson's referenced in order to have your license renewed. Even with our 99% compliance rate, you saw we had a number of variances, community experts, other permissions. We have the federal shortage areas for 2010 for the state of Minnesota, and this will be several pages long. We have dance, medical careers, communication technology careers, transportation, theater, hospitality services, bilingual elementary, all world languages, keyboarding for computer applications, construction careers, manufacturing careers, special education specific to emotional behavior disorder, physical education, mathematics, physics, chemistry, science at the 5-8 level, special education early childhood, earth and space science, special education learning disabilities and developmental disabilities, English as a second language, deaf and hard of hearing. These are all areas that Minnesota has shown has difficulty finding fully licensed teachers. Every 2 years, my office prepares for the legislature a supply and demand report. It's based on a survey that we do with Minnesota superintendents where we say, given the last 2 years, where did you experience difficulty in finding fully licensed teachers? We've not completed that report as of today. It is currently being drafted, will be submitted to the legislature when it's completed, which should be very shortly. That is separate from the federal shortage areas. It will have very strong overlap. You will also see overlap between the shortage areas and the number of permissions that are granted. So each of those permissions that I talked about a minute ago are generally going to be in one of the areas that are on the shortage list. Not always, but generally. That was a very fast overview. I wanted to give you a lot of time for questions. And at this time, I'm stand ready for questioning.
Thank you, Mr. Mielek. And at this time, we'll entertain questions. Representative Norton.
Thank you very much for your presentation. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm looking at some information that some of the staff pulled together, and it said there are 262,000 plus valid teaching licenses in the state, and I understand some of those are duplicates. But when we look at those shortage areas, do we know, are those even looking at these unemployed teachers who have valid licenses who are choosing not to teach, or is that just the 56,000, or I guess looking at people, jobs that are posted and people that are actually trying to apply for and fill those jobs? Because it seems like there are a lot of licensed teachers in the state of Minnesota. They're just not all teaching.
Mr. Mielek.
Madam Chair, committee members, that's a great question. And that number is pretty accurate. We do have about that many teachers in the state of Minnesota. Many of those are retired. Many of those don't live in the state. There are some duplicates, but actually I think for an unduplicated headcount, that's a real fair number. Even given the 260,000 plus teachers that we have available, we do continue to have shortage areas in specific areas. When we look at the supply and demand of teachers in the state of Minnesota, we do look at that database. We look at the number of teachers who are being prepared in Minnesota colleges today. And we do look at the number of the 56,000 and where they're at. And there will, the shortages oftentimes will be geographically located, although some shortage areas are universal, special education, math, science. Those tend to be areas that even with those impressive numbers of licensed teachers in Minnesota, we still have a hard time finding fully licensed teachers for those positions.
Representative Carlson.
My question is somewhat along the same line, and I'm picking up on the terms you used. When you were talking about the shortage areas, you said difficult. They were having a difficult time finding teachers. So does that mean they didn't find someone, or simply because they had to work a little bit harder? And related to that, is some of that geographic? I have a family in my district where their daughter had an opportunity to teach in Greater Minnesota but preferred for her own reasons to remain in the Twin Cities, and interesting enough happened to be special ed. So if you could comment about how maybe how much of that may be geographic, you know, the bright lights of the Twin City or a large regional center as opposed to some of the other communities, or what do you mean by difficult in finding a teacher in a given field?
Mr. Mielek.
Madam Chair, members. Difficult, the way I'm using it here, is if the position is half-time or less, the district has to advertise within their district. So that their pool will be generally around their geographic location. If it's half-time or more, they actually have to advertise it statewide. They have to show us that they put a good faith effort into finding a teacher. So they've used one of the recognized statewide advertising systems. What they're telling us when they do that is that they did not find that appropriately licensed teacher. And they may have found teachers in their district who have a license that they could use differently. They may have found a community member or someone else who they feel, for one reason or another, could come in and fill that position. So the difficulty is that they have looked for a fully licensed teacher and were unable to find one for that position. We do see outstate Minnesota in different regions has more difficulty in some of the subject areas than the metro. So, for example, most of us, I think, acknowledge that elementary education is not a shortage area. But you did see bilingual elementary education on the shortage list. And that would be more specific to the Twin Cities, where you have a large group of students whose first language is not English. So you may have a teacher who's actually doing their elementary education in a different language. We also have an elementary shortage in world languages in the immersion settings, and that's across the state where we don't have the number of people with the language expertise to teach in those language areas. But to answer your question, we do have definite geographic shortage areas. Those are highlighted in our supply and demand report, so you'll have the updated numbers when we complete the 2011 supply and demand report. You'll see that across the state there are different regions that have different troubles in different areas.
Thank you.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Malik, looking at the numbers on the last item on our licensure numbers, 99.74 seems like an incredibly high number, and I'm just wondering how that ranks with other states in the union. But if I could just have a follow-up with that question.
Mr. Malik.
Madam Chair, committee members, we're very proud of that number. For compliance purposes in Minnesota, we do an outstanding job. We're one of the top states in the nation for our compliance rates. We have a very rigorous licensing system compared to the rest of the nation in the first place, and so we're very proud of that 99% compliance.
And Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Benson.
I do know that many times when districts have difficulty filling certain positions, that teachers are teaching outside their licensure. And I'm just wondering how widespread that is and if you have any numbers on that. And then maybe, I don't know if you had an opportunity to look at the morning newspaper, and there was an evaluation of Minnesota education performance, and I think we were given a C or a D plus. And just wonder if you have any comment on those. First of all, then, how common is it to give licensure or allow teachers to teach out of their field in the state? And then secondly, if you have any opportunity to have looked at the morning paper report.
Mr. Malik.
Madam Chair, committee members, unfortunately, I like the next speaker, Karen Palmer, was caught in traffic and have not seen the morning paper yet. I do look forward to reading that. The number of people who are not on a full license on this slide are the 3.3% that are not covered in the 96.7. So the 96.71% are fully licensed, appropriately licensed for their teaching assignment, and then the limited license, variance waiver, community expert non-renewal expired, and then a small portion, no license or permission, are the people who are teaching the areas they're not licensed. One of the things that we do with the state is twice a year we run what's called the staff automated reporting system, and if any of you are from the district, which I know many of you are, that's the wonderful STAR system. And what STAR does is districts tell us every position they have in the district. And then they tell us who's in that system. They tell us the name, the file folder number. And then what we do is behind the scenes, we crunch all of our numbers together, bounce them back and forth, and then that tells us where we have errors. And so, for example, we'll have a higher discrepancy the first time we run those numbers. And that's due to the fact that people change their names, doesn't reflect in our system. And so we'll have to call the district and say, well, you reported so-and-so. And they'll say, oh, no, they got married or they got this and they have a new name. One of the other most common mistakes that happens is someone miskeys in a file folder number. So if you think of Minneapolis or St. Paul and all the teachers they have, it's not uncommon to have a data entry error. And we clean a lot of those up very easily. That's how we also know that the 0.22% is in the classroom, no license, no permission. And so what we do in that instance, and is what we're actually doing right now, is we work with the district to get that person an appropriate permission. There are a number of avenues available to the district to bring that person into compliance.
Go ahead, Representative Benson.
Just to follow up on that, if I may. Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, while these people who have no license at all, are they permitted to continue in the classroom? And if so, what happens to the kids?
Mr. Malik.
Madam Chair, committee members, the agency does not want those people to be in the classroom, and that's why we have the technical service where we'll contact the districts and say, here's how we can make that person compliant. The district will oftentimes have a mentor or some other support plan for that teacher for that person without the license, but the students will have that person in the classroom. We do turn the list of teachers over to the Board of Teaching for follow-up from the board. My office does not handle any teacher discipline or administrative discipline. We strictly issue the license and look at compliance. And so what we will do is to notify the appropriate board that we have discrepancies out in the districts and turn it over to them for their investigation and work that they do.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Mulick, just looking at those statistics, those percentages, which other state might come close to having the numbers we have, especially under fully certified or in compliance?
Madam Chair, members, the states, I think, who have similar type compliance rates that we would have are going to be Massachusetts, Rhode Island. They're the first two that come to mind. It's not going to be the states that you see in the news where they say, you know, we need 30,000 teachers over the next school year. They're in a much different situation than Minnesota is. And with the large numbers, one of the things that I mentioned was that a lot of those people in 260,000 don't come to Minnesota. We're a feeder state for the rest of the nation in many of our licensure areas, where our students will go to other states who are having difficulty. And the Minnesota license is very well respected across the country in that respect. We have a number of people who work with my office, and they say, you know, I want to get a Minnesota license. And we say, well, this is kind of strange. You have an address in Texas or Louisiana or what have you. And they say, would I know if I get my license in Minnesota that I'm going to be able to take it and I can go to, you know, three or four states around me, opposed to if I get the license in my home state, I'm stuck in my home state. So our license is very well respected across the country.
Thank you, Mr. Mulick. Representative McFarland.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Mulick. Last year we had a lot of discussion about the basic skills test. It's my understanding is that the students have to take the basic skills test to enter a teacher prep program and have to take the test before graduating from, but don't necessarily have to pass the test. Could you verify that and also expand on it if you can?
Mr. Mulick.
Madam Chair, committee members, that is correct. The basic skills test has to be attempted. It does not have to be passed in order to earn the license. You will not earn the full five-year license. You will earn a one-year license. In order to renew that license, you have two options. One is you can take the test and pass, and we're very thrilled you get your full five-year license. The other would be is if you take that test and do not pass, we could give you another year. We can do that three times. At the end of the 3 years, if you've not passed that basic skills test, you're done in the state of Minnesota until you do pass that test.
Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Even though I was tardy, I was not just dilly-dallying around. I was home reading the morning newspapers, and I read the report also that Representative Benson referred to, although he did both, got here on time and read the paper. There was a report from Education Week, so we know that's a highly respected source for studies and reports. And we did get a poor grade, and it was largely because of our quality of teachers, and not that we don't have good teachers, but we don't support them well enough. And one of the specific charges against us was that we don't have the best teachers in the schools that need them the most, where they have the large achievement gaps. And so could you tell me in your figures here how that correlates with highly qualified teachers being in the hardest to teach schools? Do they get less fully licensed? Are they more apt to not be in that 96.71 fully certified teacher category?
Mr. Mulick.
Madam Chair, committee members, we will, a couple of things. One is with the highly qualified, they're part of our state plan that we submitted to the federal government in 2006 was a plan to identify teachers who didn't have the content knowledge, identify them by district, and the attempt was to make sure that we were not loading districts with non-highly qualified teachers. That's part of the plan. Again, that's looking at a content expertise, so either passing the test or having a academic major in the field. That's not based on teacher performance. And so it's not a measure of how they do in the classroom. It's a and same with the license. It's not a guarantee someone will be effective. It's a measure that they have the content knowledge. And when we look at the numbers in the people on special permissions in districts, again, I think we will have some disparity even within the metro of where those numbers exist. I don't have the specific numbers for you today of which areas we would see the different shortages or people without the appropriate licenses being in the classroom, but there will be disparities across the state, even in the metro, of where we will have some schools that have a higher number than others.
Representative Geiling, follow-up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. But you do, Mr. Mielek, you do have that information, and could you get it to us then?
Mr. Mielek.
Madam Chair, committee members, I do have that information. We prepare two reports, two additional reports for the legislature specific to this. One is the rule exemptions report, which is available on our website. That does tell district by district where these different permissions exist, so I do have those numbers. And we also publish the discrepancy report, which is where do we have the discrepancies in the classroom, so I'd be happy to share those with you.
Mr. Mielek, in regard to Race to the Top application of last year, to what extent is what you're telling us a part of the rejection of that application?
Madam Chair,
Mr. Mielek.
Madam Chair, committee members, unfortunately, I don't have an answer for that. I'm not sure exactly how much this would have weighed into the decision. As you recall, we did submit an application for Race to the Top. In the first application process, we were denied. We did have substantial feedback as to why our application was denied, and then did make the choice not to reapply for the second round of Race to the Top. As far as the licensing in Minnesota, we did have a number of initiatives in Race to the Top that did deal with licensure, specifically in alternative pathways, as well as teacher tenure and teacher effectiveness.
Thank you, Mr. Mielek. Representative Barrett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Mielek. I have two questions for you, both related to the turnaround time as it relates to teachers applying for a license and actually receiving a license from your department. One is personal in nature. My wife actually just graduated from Mankato State University, Minnesota State University, Mankato now, and with a special education degree in learning disability. Just completed her her student teaching and is now currently waiting for an application or response to her application. What is the turnaround time for new teachers? And what is it? What is it supposed to be? What is it on average currently going through your area?
Mr. Mielek.
Madam Chair, committee members. We have a couple of different time frames that we typically deal with, and they correlate to graduation of Minnesota teachers. So particularly in the summer and then January, February, we have a lot of applications because of new graduates. We have two licensing specialists who issue all the licenses for the state of Minnesota. And then we do have one person who works on special education, so a total of three staff who issue all the licenses, both administrative and teaching, for the entire state. Our typical turnaround when we don't have the graduates will be 4 to 6 weeks. When we have new graduates, depending on the amount of new graduates, that processing time can vary. At times we will run 8 to 12 weeks, particularly during the summer. That's kind of the ballpark we give to people. Is this going to take about 8 to 12 weeks to get through the system? There may be peak periods where it does take longer than that, just given the number of applications we have in our office.
So,
follow-up, Representative Barrett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So if a person graduates in May and they would like to get a job in the fall, that's prime time for you folks. It would be the 12-week period would possibly delay their ability to get a job in the fall, especially in some special areas in which we are needing teachers to fill holes in a particular classroom. Can you expand on that just a little bit more as far as the time delay in trying to get a license when you're fully qualified?
Mr. Mielek.
Madam Chair, board members. I wish I could turn around every application in 24 hours. That would be ideal. Unfortunately, we just are unable to do that with the limited staff we have. We do understand that districts have needs, and what we try to do is if a person has a job offer pending, we offer them what we call an expedite service, and we pull them to the top of the stack and get that taken care of right away. Unfortunately, in the fall, what happens is every position becomes critical, and we will get a number of expedites, and so you can imagine our stack of normal processing has now been moved over to a stack of expedites, and it becomes kind of a moot point. But we do try to be as expedient as we possibly can with the licenses, and I do tell people if they experience a longer than normal processing time to contact me directly, and I'll definitely see what I can do to take care of that.
Mr. Mulick, because you're using the Center for Educator Licensing now for renewal, is that submitted by the individual teacher, or is it done by the chair of the recertification committee, Mr. Mulick?
Madam Chair, committee members, the Center for Educator Licensing does handle the renewal process for a majority of Minnesota teachers. And the way that it works is that districts have continuing education committees in which they submit their clock hours. The committee reviews those, makes sure that they've met all of the components that Ms. Larson's referenced, and then enters those systems into what we call the clock hour system. Then what happens is once those numbers have been uploaded, the teacher can come in and they can apply for their renewal. If we see both of those things happen in a relatively harmonious way, the typical turnaround on a renewal will be 48 hours. We're just verifying that they have those hours into the system. So that process runs fairly smooth.
Thank you, Mr. Mulick. Representative Barrett had a follow-up. I'm sorry, I
interfered. Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. The question is relates to teachers that come in from out of state who are fully licensed in the state that they have been teaching in. Situation in my life, a good friend of ours married someone from Ohio who came to Minnesota, fully qualified teacher. It took her, in her mind, an excessive amount of time to become qualified in our state, which is neither here nor there, but she is actually she grades AP history exams as part of a national board, 20 years experience. To what extent does her experience in another state, her actual work experience, trump any educational history she may or may not have, college graduate and all that, but does experience at all come into play as part of your qualifications for whether someone can get a license in Minnesota?
Mr. Mulick.
Madam Chair, committee members, I'm going to answer that two different ways, and I'm not trying to be feisty. Unfortunately, no. The licensing process does not recognize experience. Strictly the courses that you've taken. That's in statute and board rule. We don't have the ability to say, let us come watch you in the classroom, and if we can see that you're a great teacher, we can issue a license, or someone tells us you're a great teacher, or you've completed 30 years. We can't factor any of that into our decision. So the first answer is no. We do have what we call the licensure via portfolio, which is a process that we created in the early 2000s, which allows a teacher to demonstrate that they've met the standards. In addition to their coursework, we are able to look at their classroom teaching experience, professional development activities they've done. We can look at a much broader picture of that person through that process. If the person completes that portfolio process successfully, then they would be able to earn a license. So while the short answer is no, there is an avenue that we can recognize experience gained in other states.
Representative Barrett, quickly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the fact that she has met a standard to grade AP history exams does not at all come into play for your department to understand whether she is qualified to teach a class in history.
Mr. Mulick.
Madam Chair, committee members, unfortunately not in the licensing process, but again through the portfolio process where we can look at that broader picture of the experiences of the individual. In that respect, we definitely could and would look at that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mielek. We'll have two more questions. Representative Brandon Peterson, followed by Representative Carlson, and then we want to move to Ms. Ballmer. So, Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I think part of the problem that was pointed out by Representative Benson and Representative Greeling earlier was the correlation, or maybe lack thereof, of teacher effectiveness with the licensure itself. Is there any data on that correlation? And then also, how about the 3.3% that maybe have an alternative license, as we define it in statute right now? Do you have any data on that?
Mr. Mielek.
Madam Chair, committee members, unfortunately we don't. Minnesota does not have a definition of what teacher effectiveness is. And so without a measure of what it is, it's difficult for us to give you numbers that are really meaningful. So from that standpoint, we do not have numbers that would indicate effectiveness of someone on a full license versus one of the permissions.
Thank you.
Representative Carlson, last question.
Yeah, mine was more a comment that I'd like you to respond to. It's a follow-up to the question about the person from Ohio. In my family, we had kind of a reverse situation. My daughter, licensed in Minnesota, married a pilot that ended up flying out of the Cincinnati area. Their airport happens to be in northern Kentucky. And by the way, her Minnesota license played very well. But she still did have certain requirements to meet Kentucky's requirement because she was in social studies. And one of the Kentucky requirements, and I think we may have the same one here, she had to take a course in the history of Kentucky or something like that as a social studies teacher. Do we have that requirement if they were coming from another state into Minnesota?
Mr. Mielek.
Madam Chair, committee members. Yes, there are a number of Minnesota-specific courses you would need to take for different licensure areas. Social studies would be one where we would look at some of that. We also require a Minnesota Native American course that people need to complete when they're moving into Minnesota that is specific to Minnesota tribes. And so there will be a number of courses people do have to complete when they move to Minnesota. But as you pointed out, that's true when you go to other states as well. Most states have some additional pieces that you will need to get in different licensure areas.
Madam Chair, what I was picking up on was the reference that she was apparently a social studies teacher dealing with a history exam, and I wouldn't be surprised that that may have been one of the criteria she had to meet here in Minnesota, of course, Minnesota history or geography or something like that.
Thank you, Representative Carlson, and thank you, Mr. Mielek, very much for this enlightening presentation. Didn't realize we all had so many questions about the licensing process, but it's important for us to know as we proceed. Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome, Ms. Ballmer.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Karen Ballmer. I'm the Executive Director for the Minnesota Board of Teaching, and I need to start by apologizing to you this morning for being late. I do really appreciate and am honored by this opportunity to be with you, and I do sincerely apologize for being late, and I look forward to working with you this session in a timely manner. So with that, we will pull up my presentation, and hopefully you have that handout as well. And we'll get going. But my objectives here this morning, and in listening to your questions, I look forward to not only a good conversation today, but throughout the session, because the questions you're asking are exactly the kinds of things we are grappling with at the Board of Teaching. So my intent for you today is just to frame some of the Board of Teaching's work and to give you some handles on what we are doing. You will have ideas about what we should be doing or should not be doing, and we'll go from there. So please allow me to jump in, and we'll get going, and I welcome your questions and comments along the way. I thought I would start with just a really brief legislative history this morning. Going back to our roots, our roots go back to the late 1960s, actually, when the legislature started talking about this idea of some kind of a body that would have to do with teacher licensing. And so what you see here are the names, the iterations of who we have been. We started as the Professional Teaching Practices Commission. Then we were the Teacher Standards and Certification Commission. Then we were the Board of Teachers, Standards and Certification, and now we are the Board of Teaching, and we've been that since the mid-1970s. So we have been around a long time. We are created by the legislature. We serve you as a state agency, and certainly work at your direction and under your authority. Our charge is found in state law, and specifically 122A05. And you see what we are. Our purpose in the sections of statute that are provided there. Is to develop standards of ethical conduct for the guidance and improvement of the teaching profession, and to provide measures through which the observance of standards by the members of the profession may be promoted and enforced. So we really are all about teacher preparation and trying to serve our kids well in that way. So the Board of Teaching took that and many years ago created a mission statement, and it's fairly straightforward. It is to establish and maintain standards for a quality teacher licensing system for Minnesota public schools. There's no surprises there. Then you get to our vision statement, which we've also had for a number of years. This is where it gets a little dicey. We are to maintain high licensure standards while providing flexibility in the licensing process to assure that our public school students have fully licensed teachers. And you've just been talking about those things. And this, in every policy discussion that we have, and I anticipate that you will have here, herein lies the challenge. High expectations, accountability, rigor, that gold standard versus flexibility and reality, and not always having a licensed teacher available, and when the ideal is simply not achievable for one reason or another. And so this is where we find ourselves continually grinding in every policy discussion that we have. You need to know that I represent this board, and the board is made up of real people. There are 11 members, and we are statutorily governed in terms of our composition. So you can see the names of our members currently. They're governor appointees and serve 4-year terms. And you can see on the right-hand side their label, their role on the board. And again, statute tells us that we must have, of course, a majority of teachers on the Board of Teaching. So we have 6 licensed and practicing teachers, and then we have a host of other members as defined by our statute. What I wanted to do with you this morning is take you through this model, and it's sort of a conceptual framework for us that helps us to organize whatever we do, where it falls within our authority. And so what we did last summer and this fall is we tried to really think about what is it that our charge and purview is. And so we've broken that into three areas. We prepare teachers, and there are several things that we do within preparation. And then we allow teachers to teach, and we get them in the classroom. And so there are several things under that. And then we want them to grow, and that is part of our responsibility as well, as we have those clock hour rules. And so what I would do this morning with you is just talk through each of those pieces. I'm sure that you'll have questions and things will interest you along the way, and so please make note of the places that you want to come back and circle back to. But under prepare, what we do is we approve institutions. We've got 32 institutions across the state of Minnesota, from Morris to Winona to Bemidji and up in Crookston and down to Southwest State. And so we've got 7 Minsky institutions. We've got over a dozen. We've got the 4 University of Minnesota system institutions, and then the rest are private institutions that prepare teachers. So they go through an approval process. For example, you will not see community colleges in this list. These are 4-year accredited colleges and universities across the state that we have approved and to do the work of preparing teachers. Within that, then once each institution is approved, they say, well, gosh, we want to prepare elementary teachers, physics teachers, life science teachers, and middle school math teachers. And each of those licensure programs has an approval process. So to date, we've got over 650 licensure programs up and running throughout the state of Minnesota. Some institutions have just a very few number. Carleton, for example, only prepares a few, they only have a few licensure programs for secondary teachers, and then you get other programs like Minnesota State Mankato, where they have dozens of licensure programs, and at the end of the day, it adds up to a lot of licensure programs across the state. We have a host of licensure rules, and I thought I would... We're not connected to the internet here, so we're going to skip that. But what you'd find there is that you would see our rules broken down into several categories. And here they are listed for you. We've got several rules that govern our requirements and procedures. So how do we treat our out-of-state applicants? Our licensure testing rules. Those are found here in the Board of Teaching Rules. We've got teacher standards in 40-plus fields. So what are the actual standards that you need to be an agriculture teacher? What are the actual content competency standards to be a business education teacher, an elementary education teacher? So you'll find 40 plus, I think it's 42 of those in our rules. Then you find rules that govern other school professionals. These are your school nurses, your school psychologists, school counselors, speech language pathologists. So those fall under our purview. And then we've got a whole section for career and technical education teachers, our communications careers, manufacturing careers teachers. You find those rules there as well. And what I did here is I just pulled a snapshot. So you could start to see how we get to that 650 number. And you'll find us on our web, and I can point you to it if you're interested. But what you see along the left-hand side is a handful of our licensure fields. And then across the top, you see those institutions. And you see how pretty quickly we get to 650 programs, licensure programs in the state. So these are resources that we have available for you as you go through your policy discussions and reform discussions this session. So again, under the prepare idea, we do hold those preparation rules, and we take them very seriously. And so I listed for you just a couple of initiatives that we've taken on over the last couple years that to try to strengthen those preparation standards. Because once we have preparation standards, that's what those teacher candidates receive in their programs. We determine those standards at the Board of Teaching. What does it mean to be a reading teacher? Those standards translate into program design and coursework for the teacher candidates. So in the last couple years, we have taken on reading preparation in a very significant way. There was actually statutory language to spur us onto that and to partner with us in that a couple years ago. So we have done a great deal. And actually, those rules just became effective this fall. So that our elementary candidates and early childhood candidates in particular have a great deal of increased focus on reading and intervention and the things that we know kids need. But not just elementary and early childhood. Actually, most of our content area teachers have an increased attention to reading so that they can help. Even if a student of theirs has difficulty reading, we don't expect a social studies teacher to remediate them, but we do expect that social studies teacher to be able to help that candidate access the content so that they can still be successful in social studies while they work with a reading teacher on their those reading skills. So those are the kinds of things we do. We work to increase the rigor of our middle-level licensure standards. We've done that in a targeted way. Technology-related licensure, that's a difficult one for us because, as you know, technology is a moving target, and it changes all the time. So to capture language that won't be obsolete by the time it's effective is difficult. But we have worked and made some strides in that. And we've also established, at the direction of the legislature, a voluntary paraprofessional credential. So hopefully this gives you starts to give you a flavor of the kind of work that we do at the Board of Teaching. As far as current rulemaking, we are in one very significant rulemaking initiative, and it has to do with special education licenses. We have 10 licenses currently that prepare different types of special education teachers. Learning disabilities is one of them, as we've heard already. There are a host of others, deaf and hard of hearing, blind, visually impaired, and a host of others. So we have strengthened the current special education rules and are thrilled about that, in addition to proposing two new special education licenses, one specific to teachers that would serve students who have autism spectrum disorders, and then another that is a what some call a generalist, a broad license called an academic and behavioral strategist that we're very excited about. And I would be very happy to share information with you about any of these initiatives that we have moving along the way as well. is outside of rulemaking, an official rulemaking process, we do have a very significant initiative moving along, and it has to do with the question we heard earlier, Representative Peterson, about how do you get to teacher effectiveness? What data do you have? What measures do you use? And so what we have been working on since 2008 is redesigning this a program approval system. So how is it that we approve a licensure program and we have some sense that that program is turning out teachers that are ultimately effective in the classroom? That's the million-dollar question. How do you do that? So that's the redesign that we have been in now for a couple of years. And what we've come up with is this framework that we call PERCA, because everything needs a sort of the alphabet soup. And so PERCA stands for Program Effectiveness Reports for Continuing Approval. So... And I have to make a special note of, and bullet the teacher performance assessment, which I hope you will hear more and more about. And I'm going to go into some detail in just a moment. But first, wanted to kind of frame for you, what is PERCA? What will that look like? How will we try to make an analysis that a licensure program is, in fact, graduating teachers that will become effective in the classroom? Well, we're going to collect a host of data points. And the first set of data points we call Tier 1, and those are basically what you could think of as your program design measures. What courses do you require? What kinds of clinicals do you require? What's your student teaching look like? What faculty do you have delivering the content to your teacher candidates? So we're going to collect those, not just to collect them, but at the end of the day, we want to be able to do some meaningful analysis, and I'll come back to that in a moment. Then this is the heart of the redesign. We are moving towards actually collecting data that we think will tell us something about these teacher candidates. Our former process has been we just gather syllabi from our colleges and universities, and we hope that on the basis of seeing that a particular standard is delivered in a course, that that'll translate to teacher effectiveness. We don't have any data to support that. So that's what we're moving from, away from, towards performance measures. And actually, there's legislation that we've had on the books since the mid-90s that has pointed us to this, and we have not been able to get there. And so we think we're finally moving towards that target. So what this Tier 2 will do is these programs will give us data points on their teacher candidates, on the teacher performance assessment that I'm going to speak to in a little greater detail in a moment, on the tests. You've already mentioned this morning we were required in state law to administer those tests in content and pedagogy as well as basic skills. And then we've got surveys. There's more and more in the literature right now about perception data. And what we will be gathering is data from the candidate and from that candidate's supervisor, likely a principal, a year after they've completed their program. And that's what you see down here. Two surveys will factor into this program approval decision that we will make in an ongoing way. So at the end of that first year teacher's first year, so they're a year out from graduating from a Minnesota college or university, they will fill out this survey and it's already been field tested. So we have a psychometrically sound instrument that will feed data back about that candidate's reflection on how prepared was I? When I got thrown into the deep end and had a classroom this year, how prepared was I? Similarly, the supervisor survey is a companion and will ask the supervisor, again, likely the principal, to also reflect on that candidate's preparedness after observing and being in that candidate's classroom. So these are the data points we're working towards. The supervisor survey is currently in development. It will be field tested this spring. And so we hope we're on target for a launch of all these things by a year from now in the spring. Finally, as part of PERCA, we're going to ask these programs to do a formal data analysis and continuing improvement reflection to us. And that's what all teachers are in the business of, is this ongoing practice of reflection and using data to inform practice. Well, that's what we will ask them for here. And so all of that will roll up into the program approval for these licensure programs. Now, a couple words about the teacher performance assessment, because this is one that we are thrilled about. We have a wonderful opportunity coming out of Stanford University. The principal researcher is Linda Darling Hammond, and she has been long at this work. out in California for what they call PACT, and it's the third bullet, the Performance Assessment for California Teachers. We do have the benefit of having an instrument that's been field tested and piloted broadly in another state. Now, as a result of that work, there are 20 states that are actually in this project with Stanford, and we're one of four accelerated states. We've been identified as ready, well-positioned to actually scale this up statewide. And the teacher performance assessment is a classroom-based, during student teaching, assessment that allows an independent reviewer to see their planning, their instruction, their delivery, their assessment, to see student work, and to actually see, there's a video component as well, to see real-time, in front of actual real kids, a snapshot of their teaching. And we believe this is one of the strongest measures, if not the strongest measure, that we've ever had available to actually start to get at that question of teacher effectiveness. Now, what California is starting to see, and the Stanford research team, because they're researchers and they're purists, and they are now always starting to circle back in a very meaningful way to connecting the results of this performance assessment to, okay, now those teachers are in the field. How does it correlate with actual student gains and their actual achievement in the classroom? What we're starting to see, because those candidates did it, now they've been in the classroom for a couple years, we're starting to see some research that does show predictive value, that a teacher that performs well on this will in fact perform well in the classroom. And we would love to sit down and show you this instrument in a more in-depth way. This is just a high-level overview. Our national partners are AACTE, which of course is the Association for Colleges of Teacher Education. So we've got the support of those that actually deliver teacher preparation, but also it's critical to know that it's not just a higher ed thing. CCSSO is very much at the table. This is the K-12 presence, the P-12 presence, I'm sorry. There is broad support for this, so we're thrilled at the partnership that has unfolded on this work. Minnesota specific, the Bush Foundation has generously gifted us with $200,000 to be moving in this direction. They are a strong partner for us. The Department of Education has worked closely with us. MACTE, which is our Minnesota Association of Colleges for Teacher Education, and of course the board is thrilled about this work. Madam Chair, please let me know if I need to speed things along.
You're doing just fine, Ms. Baumer. Continue.
Okay. So then I thought I would move to the second sort of layer of what we do, which is that teach. We get teachers into the classroom. They have to meet the Board of Teaching's requirements before they actually get that license to be in front of kids. So we've got licensure tests. Again, you've heard about this, that this is our statutory obligation. We have just revised the teacher licensure testing program. We were formerly with a program called Praxis, and we've just now moved and developed our own licensing test structure to what we call Minnesota Teacher Licensure Examinations. And I would be happy to send you the link so that you can see it. And what I wanted to note about these licensure tests is that as we thought about our contract was up, we had to let this out for bid, and that's what led to a change. So our contract was up. That gave us an opportunity to say, what do we want in a testing program? What's important to us? And at the time, this was a couple years ago, at the time, one of the really startling questions that we had stumbled into was the question of, well, gosh, you got a social studies license, as an example. Social studies teachers in Minnesota, they're prepared to teach seven different things, from psychology and sociology to civics and government and political science, history, economics, and seven things. And the question came to us, could a teacher candidate fail every economics question and still pass that social studies test and get a social studies license? And we had to say, yes, that is possible. Obviously, that's not something that we're comfortable with. And so as we had this opportunity to think about how we wanted to design these tests, what we did is we said, we want a system that drills more deeply into the content and doesn't allow for a candidate to compensate with a strength for a weakness. So what we did is we had this MTLE system developed with using a subtest model. So instead of taking one test that's 100 questions, and we set a cut score in there, and you got to pass some, and hopefully you do well in everything, but you might have a weak area that you don't. In this paradigm, what happens is there are two subtests. And so it's enough to make a high-stakes decision there's an, the N is large enough to be still psychometrically sound, but what ultimately ends up happening is those candidates are tested on a more narrow band of content. So you have to, there's less opportunity to compensate with a strength for a weakness in this test design. So, and there's a cut score for each subtest, and they have to pass both subtests to get the license. So we have built into the system an increase in the accountability for it. So we're excited about that, and I'd be happy to show you concretely how these tests look, and we've got lots of information on the website about that. Then as far as the teach responsibility that we have, we do issue that initial license, and that's much of what you just heard Director Milik talk about in terms of the licensing process. We have to get a recommendation from a licensing officer at one of our approved institutions, from an approved program, and so there's that whole process of actually getting that initial license that falls under our purview. And then you also heard Director Milik talk about special permissions, and that goes back to our vision. It's not always possible for a school administrator to find the exactly appropriately licensed teacher. So we do have a host of special permissions. And so the way we can talk in greater detail about any of these, but it is important to note that two of them are actually authorized in statute. These are found in statute, the non-licensed community expert and the waiver, innovative experimental program waivers, as they're sometimes called. Then we have several that are authorized under Board of Teaching rule, and those are your variances and a couple of different kinds of limited licenses. And so we have a host of options. In most cases, when we have an administrator panicked calling us that they found someone but they're not appropriately licensed, we typically have a way to recognize that and to allow that administrator to place someone. So in most cases, we're able to find a solution when that happens. Then finally, we have this portion of our purview that has to do with GROW. We don't expect that a teacher is a master as they complete their preparation. In fact, that's fully impossible. It takes time to grow and develop in the profession. We do have some candidates that are highly they're more ready than others, and they're just natural, and we see some of those. But we know that initial license is just that. It's an initial. It's an entry into the profession, and like any profession, you grow. And so one thing that we take very seriously is the code of ethics, that above all, teachers are people in positions of authority over children, and they have a great deal of influence, and they have a great deal of captured attention, and we take that very seriously. And in two places, we've got specific language in Minnesota statute and Minnesota rule that governs our code of ethics. And so first and foremost, we want those teachers to be good people that are standing up in front of our kids. And so this statutory language and rule language gives us parameters for situations and instances where that's not the case, and the board does take disciplinary action against a teacher's license to suspend, not very often, but sometimes we revoke a license. We place teachers on all kinds of different remedial plans or last chance agreements and those kinds of things. The number of teachers that we have to do this for is very small, because most of our teaching force is wonderful, and they are there for the right reasons, and they are the people that we want and need in front of our kids. You have a few that aren't, and so these are our handles for dealing with those. Then we get to the license renewal, and this takes me back again to this idea of GROW, that currently we require 125 clock hours every 5 years. We have some statutorily set requirements within that have to do with teachers routinely being refreshed and growing in their understanding of mental health for kids, in reading strategies, in positive behavior intervention strategies, and adaptation of curriculum and materials. And then we now have one per Board of Teaching rule that relates to technology for specific to instruction. I think that the Board of Teaching, I would safely say, is eager to look at this system, to look at whether this is the best way to capture a teacher's growth. we hope and we think that there is a way to better reflect a teacher's growth in the profession. For example, that initial license, that first 5-year standard license, it's the exact same requirements that 25 years later that same teacher is doing. And there is no reflection of master teacher or a teacher that might be coaching and mentoring brand new to the profession teachers. We don't have a mechanism for that. We're one of actually a few states that don't right now. And we would really welcome an opportunity to engage that discussion about how we build a system that doesn't have teachers just checking boxes and then doing the real work of their professional growth in their professional learning community at their district or as they're mentoring new teachers or being mentored, and our clock hours is just kind of this extra thing that they have to do. We would love a way to pull that together into a cohesive system that honors teachers as they grow and expects teachers. And we know that it's happening. We have examples across the state of districts that are doing marvelous things as they grow the young teachers, as they use their master teachers to through career ladders and opportunities to really stabilize that workforce, to reduce the number of teachers that exit the classroom within the first 5 years. There are a lot of things that we can do and talk about, and so we welcome any opportunities that you might give us to work with you on that. So, Madam Chair and members, that is a very crash course, and I welcome your questions.
Thank you very much, Ms. Vollmer. That was just the best. And members, I did serve on the Board of Teaching for 5 years, and what I noticed when I was serving, that was the time when we were moving, by the way, into standards-based, but I did notice that teachers often were not aware of the code of ethics. So, Ms. Vollmer, to what extent has that changed now, that our teachers in the field are more aware of what the code of ethics is that they pledge to when they step into that classroom? Ms. Vollmer.
Madam Chair, you know, this is something I think we will continually wrestle with. We do have one full-time staff member. We're a small staff, but one of those staff members is our teacher ethics specialist, and it is her full-time job to be handling inquiries and investigations. And what we say is, Monica, I love you, but I want you to work out of a job. I wish that we had a way to get rid of the investigations that we take on and the action that we ultimately take. And so your question is a good one. How do we get that code of ethics into the hands of teachers? It's required of our teacher preparation programs. It's a standard within those preparation programs requirements to be giving these to our young and new teachers, not always young, but new to the profession. It is a requirement. But, for example, one of the things we're seeing more and more is the use of social media, and how that is at times being used very appropriately and effectively, and at other times really being used in some damaging ways, intentionally or unintentionally. And so we would love to find a way to make this more central. We haven't found it yet. It's currently a requirement. We don't make our teachers stand and take an oath, but we do know that it's woven into their preparation programs. We also know that a lot of licensure. John Mielek just gave me an extra note for you. We do know that a lot of local districts are doing more and more in their new teacher orientation, and that we think is a very good thing. It becomes very practical. It's less abstract when you're actually standing in front of kids and you're actually thinking about these things. And thank you, Director Mielek, that just reminded me that his office, upon issuance of a license, when that it goes out to the new teacher, they do also mail it. So it gets in their hands in a hard copy.
Thank you, Ms. Vollmer. We're starting with Representative Greiling has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Vollmer, I too look forward to the discussion on the last bullet point. I think it gets at the education report, or Education Week criticism. But my specific question for today is just how is the video criteria for evaluation being received? It kind of piques my interest, and I kind of like it on first blush, but I don't know that much about it, other than that I have heard it's controversial. And how is that being received, and could you tell us a little more about it?
Absolutely.
Ms. Vollmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Greiling. As I mentioned, within the teacher performance assessment, there is a video component, and this is what allows an independent off-site reviewer to actually see this teacher in action. It's about a 15 to 20-minute clip because it is around that is a host of other components of the measure. So whereas in some portrayals of the teacher performance, it has almost sounded like, oh, this is just a video. It's really important to note that it is the assessment itself is far more complex, and this is one piece of, it's an important piece. But to your direct question, the reception of it from us, from our end, has been very positive. And so, for example, I've talked with, I've got a standing advisory committee that has the human resource directors and, you know, representative and principals, elementary and secondary, and the host of all the Rural Education Association and AMSD and all the alphabet soup of folks. They are very very positive about it. The I think the question mark that we have received at the statewide steering committee for this is about the data privacy concerns. That's where the concerns lie. There's now a camera in the room. A flip cam or some other, there are lots of different devices that can do this work. But then there are real kids, and there are a host of data privacy questions that go along with that once that is then uploaded to the data warehouse for an independent reviewer to view. So we are now, with the benefit of California's work, we have some templates, some protocols of how we do the data privacy, how we inform parents and have that opt-in, or some as an opt-out. Those are things that we talk about for the release of that information. The emphasis is on the teacher, but it does, obviously, because the teacher's in a classroom, it's field-based, it's classroom-based, which is part of what makes it so strong, is that you do have the faces of real kids. And so that's been the concern that I have heard, and we are working through. We do have the benefit also of some of our early adopting institutions that have started to work with Minnesota administrators in schools, and we're starting to have some better handles on how we kind of Minnesotaize the process and the templates and protocols for the data privacy. So I don't know if that aligns with the concerns you heard.
Representative Greiling, follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know if it does or not either. I just read a newspaper article, and I heard secondhand that one of the professors of education at one of our colleges that works with teacher preparation had concerns about it. So, but I don't know enough about his concerns to know what they were exactly. But my follow-up question then is, does the student teacher know while that camera's there exactly when the 15 or 20 minutes is going to be recorded, or is it not known?
Ms. Vollmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. This, it absolutely is, actually the clip is probably hours long. The student teacher then selects the clip. The whole idea, and one of the design principles from the Stanford team, is that this is an educative instrument. This is not a gotcha. This is not a, oh my goodness, someone is showing up in my classroom today and I hope I do well. It's not a surprise. It's a planned event. It is a, and in fact, what I tell people and is that if teacher candidates don't start receiving the preparation in their first education class, their Foundations of Ed class, if there isn't some early work to prepare them by the end of student teaching, it's not going to go well. It is a complex assessment that requires candidates to know theory and why they're planning what they're planning, to know their students very well. It happens usually in the middle of student teaching after they know their candidates, they know those English language learners, they know the teaching modalities, they know their kids with special needs and their IEP, the special needs that they have for manipulatives or whatever the case would be. So it's an educative assessment that allows a teacher, even for the high-stakes assessment, to look at their own teaching and to be reviewing and reflecting, even in the process of saying, this is the part I'm gonna select for my reviewer. And I'm probably not doing justice to the whole thing with these little tidbits about it. But it is it is intended to be very much a growth experience, even to the last minute, for that teacher candidate.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Madam Chair, Ms. Ballmer, I'm intrigued by the licensing renewal, and I was just wondering if I could get a little bit more clarification on the current process. My understanding is that we have two-year provisional licenses in the state of Minnesota, followed then by a five-year license that's a more permanent license. Is that...
Ms. Ballmer?
Madam Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, that used to be the case.
Okay.
We now issue, there are a host of limited one-year licenses that you've heard both Director Milik and I talk about a little bit for specific and unique instances of not appropriately licensed, didn't pass the test. But in general, there is a one-size-fits-all. It's a full five-year standard license. So we don't have that two-year anymore.
And then to the 125 hours in a five-year period of time, does the board currently have a standard or contemplating a standard that would, in essence, not allow someone to front-load or back-load their requirements over that five-year period of time in satisfying 125 hours?
Ms. Ballmer.
Madam Chair, Representative, no, they're actually within the five-year period, anything is fair game. When the Continuing Education Committee looks at those clock hours, they cannot go back any further than 5 years. So, but within the preceding 5 years of that moment, anything is fair game. So if they took a series of classes that accrue clock hours pretty heavily early on and then didn't do anything, you know, that's possible. Given what we know about the local professional development opportunities and obligations that teachers have, I think that for most teachers it's pretty evenly spread and throughout, but we don't have any requirements about the frequency and or throughout.
Thank you.
Representative Brandon Peterson.
Madam Chair, Ms. Ballmer. I'm looking at the PERCA structure here, and it looks great. It looks like a step in the right direction. I think we'd all be interested to see how our teachers do on those tests, but I think we'd be maybe more interested to see how our students are doing on theirs. Is there any provision in there, maybe I'm missing it, for academic achievement for students included in the PERCA structure? And then I have just one follow-up.
Madam Chair, Representative Peterson, so you're asking specifically about the tie from our teachers to their P-12 student achievement.
Pupil academic achievement, yeah.
We do not have that as a requirement for the continuing program approval. Some real practical reasons we don't have for the agriculture teacher, we don't have a measure. We don't have, for many of our teachers, music teachers, art teachers, there are a host of teachers that for whom we would not have those measures. So we've not gone down that road. We know that that's a looming discussion. We think that once those instruments perhaps are in place, that we might, that we'll be ready to engage that. We haven't felt like we are far enough down the road in terms of having access to measures that we could use. These are very high-stakes decisions, and that we could apply uniformly to all teacher candidates so that it's not... perceived as harder to become a math teacher than it is to become a chemistry teacher, simply because we don't have a level playing field of the K-12 measures to even use. So we haven't gone down that road. But I anticipate that these are discussions that we will continue to have. We think this moves us in that direction in a meaningful way, though.
Yeah.
Follow-up, Representative Peterson?
Sounds like we need to maybe get some of those measures. And then I'm just looking at the teacher performance assessment on the Minnesota Partners line. See the Bush Foundation and the department, and I'm not familiar with the last two acronyms, but is Education Minnesota involved in this as well? Are they one of the partners?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. Fabulous question. Right now, the group that you see here has really been the group driving the work. Working directly with Stanford, working directly with the national partners, and Education Minnesota has not been prominently in that work. That is not to say that we have not had early conversations with them about it. In fact, they sit on that same advisory committee that I mentioned earlier with a host of other, the alphabet soup, of other stakeholders. And so we have now, because of the gift we were given by the Bush Foundation, we have just been able, actually this week, to hire a teacher performance assessment coordinator for the state. And this is our person that we have targeted to do very proactive stakeholder engagement. And so administrators and teachers are at the top of that list. Without our teachers, this doesn't happen. This happens in a Minnesota classroom during student teaching. We absolutely need them in this with us. So right now it's been a lot of the laying the groundwork, getting some funding so that we could even get to this point, doing the work that we think that the assessment itself is sound, that we have confidence in the measure to build it into this system. For example, Washington State, I think it was just in their last legislative session, there was language to direct their commission, similar to our Board of Teaching, to do this, to do the TPA. But it was not housed within the context of program approval. So they're going to do it, but they are trying to now figure out what does this mean for program approval, and can we connect it to program approval, or is it just for candidates and just for licensure? So we've kind of done the reverse, where we've said, okay, we're going to try to lay a groundwork and a framework for program approval that would include multiple measures. There's not just one data point for any program, because we don't know that is a fair way to go. So we've tried to build the system and now fill in. That's the process we've been using, but absolutely Education Minnesota and a host of other stakeholder groups are critical for our success in this.
And Representative Peterson, we will be hearing from the Bush Foundation and others in regard to the teacher performance assessment. That's some time in the future. But thank you for asking that question. Representative Barrett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Ballmer, regarding license renewal, do you have any information on what percent of the initial licensees do not renew their license? And I'm thinking specifically on a subset of that who just decide for whatever reason that, you know, teaching isn't for me. I'm not good at it. I have the academic background, but my personality or otherwise would not make me an effective teacher. Do you have any information on that subgroup that could help actually inversely determine what does make an effective teacher?
Mm-hmm. Ms. Baumer.
Madam Chair, Representative Barrett, that is another great question, and I don't have any hard data to give you. What I can point you to is work that has been happening within educator licensing with respect to the supply and demand report, which seeks to identify teachers exiting the profession. And we have not been able to capture in an objective manner as possible. We rely on surveys from school administrators and their exit interviews that they hopefully conduct, and the knowledge that they have about teachers exiting either their district or their profession. We just haven't been able to disentangle a teacher that leaves a district because of funding and is unable to secure another position and sort of matriculates out that way versus a teacher who intentionally self-selects out. Mm-hmm. We have some information that we'll be happy to get you that gets us closer with the data that we rely on from locally, but at the statewide level, we don't probably have a great barometer for you on that.
Our last two questions, Representative Willard, and then Representative Moran. Representative Willard.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Ms. Ballmer, for a very passionate presentation. It was very impressive. I did have a question on the PERCA structure. I assume is really the standard structure for approving a program, correct? Not a teacher. Is that right? Okay, so in that same basis, then there's 650 licensing programs out there that our universities are involved in. What's the thought process behind, once a student has graduated from that, having them also go through the additional basic skills licensing instead of allowing just once they've graduated that they graduated from an approved program and that then results in an automatic license?
Ms. Ballmer.
Madam Chair, Representative, in most cases, it is that they complete those basic skills requirements early in their program. They move through the program and the requirements as set forth by our rules and requirements and are recommended by, once they're recommended by that institution, they're done. In most cases, they don't need to go through their institution and then, again, back to us. It would be in the cases where they weren't able to pass the test, for example. But in some of those cases, those institutions, some will even hang on to them and say, we're not even going to give you anything to go to the state with yet. The vast majority of situations that the candidate really comes to us through their university, and it's not until we have that recommendation for licensure as a signal that everything's been done, checked off, met all the requirements, and off you go. That so in most cases it works that way.
Okay. Representative Moran.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Ms. Balmer. You have done a wonderful, wonderful job of giving us some insight into this process, so thank you so much for that. And my hope is that you can help me bring some clarity to the whole process of preparing and teaching and the growth of teachers as they enter into the classroom. Because I'm coming from a viewpoint of preparing teachers with the growing populations of communities of color to be successful in our school system. And find a way that, in my mind, there may be a disconnect as to how we can help communities of color achieve and be successful. Because right now, that achievement gap is one of the worst in the country. So have you thought, or have the Minnesota Board of Teachers thought of ways that they can implement or insert some kind of learning or measures or something that can be done to help support teachers so that they can do or find ways to connect to communities of color in a way that all our kids are being successful in school.
Ms. Balmer.
Madam Chair, Representative, there are probably two ways to think about that. One has to do with preparing all teachers to serve all kids well. And we seek to do that by our licensure standards, and we've got a host of standards that drive towards knowing and understanding student differences in learning, understanding cultural differences, understanding different types of learning environments and learning needs. So we hit it that way. We seek to do that. But I think the other question that you're asking is, how do we get the right people? How do we attract people? There is research to suggest and tell us that it does make a difference if a student is able to connect with their teacher on a host of levels, and certainly having a teacher who culturally or racially understands or ethnically them, that's one of the points where a student can connect to a teacher. And so what we are doing in one of our processes, let me mention a specific, back to my first point. For example, and I mentioned to you the reading standards. And you think reading, we're just better preparing teachers for reading. If you look and you drive into those standards, and what we have, what we've added to the mix is that is a host of standards that relate to teaching reading and understanding the learner from linguistically, culturally, ethnically, racially, from a host of, because that does impact reading instruction. And so we're trying to get at it, even in preparing all teachers for all kids. So that's one prong. The second, now I go back here, is making sure that we get the right types of folks into the classroom. And we believe that we have work to do, not just in teachers of color, serving communities of color, but there are lots of different ways to think about that. We would love to have more women chemistry teachers, physics teachers. We would love to have more male kindergarten teachers. We have things that we're trying to think about, and that becomes incumbent on the teacher preparation program in the recruitment and in the selection of people who have potential to succeed as a teacher, and in looking to target groups, all kinds of different groups of folks who are going to serve our kids well. So we are actually in a process of looking at the language right now, and I'd be happy to share with you some early language that we have that really is trying to get after that. But it falls in two ways. It's the teacher preparation standards and what do we require for all teachers who are going to serve all kinds of kids, and then it's how do we get the right people into those classrooms. So that's
Representative Moran, do you have a follow-up?
I do. Thank you, Madam Chair and Mrs. Balmer. I guess my other question is, through my experience, and definitely dealing with different cultures, there's not one model that fits all. So I was just wondering, in that process, do you work to ensure that you are being really culturally sensitive to different groups and the teacher's ability to learn how to have influence over the students and to, again, to capture students' attention.
Ms. Ballmer.
Madam Chair, Representative, we do have standards that drive towards that. In terms, and we have some specific, for example, that's driven by state law that has to do with communities of American Indian descent and their contributions in Minnesota. And so we do have some very specific things like that. And then we have more broadly language about, I don't know if we have exactly cultural sensitivity, but language around that that drives towards that. But why don't I show you what we have and let you get your hands on it and see where you think, how you think we're doing.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Ballmer. And members, she's very accessible, so please contact her or anyone else in the department to help you. This meeting is adjourned.
Thank you.